MacCast, Sunday, February 9th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. How you doing? Hope you had another great week. I am doing quite well. Much better, actually. I'm still fighting a little bit of sickness, but finally coming off of it and feeling a lot better. And looking through the news for this week, looks like we got a number of things to dive into and talk about in the world of Apple and Macintosh. We're going to get into iPad sales and what those are looking like over the last quarter, talk about sales growth for iPhone in one region in particular, get into some more Apple TV Plus subscription analysis and discussion. We'll also touch on a little bit of Apple Watch and how it's doing, and then a whole bunch of new things that were discovered in some of the latest betas that Apple has put out. Apple put out new betas for all of the OSs, and there's some nice little juicy tidbits in there that we'll get into. And we'll talk about Apple taking a little bit of heat for their indie repair program. We'll discuss how the coronavirus in China may potentially impact Apple, and round it out with some news related to iCloud.com. All of that, and then we're going to get into some of your feedback and also follow up on a few conversations from previous MacCasts. Got a great tip on automation. Going to talk about the iMac a little bit more and share some of your more of your thoughts on what you'd like to see in the next generation iMac. Got a tip for using Siri and passwords, and a thing of the moment, another thing of the moment from a listener, a cool little app for your Apple Watch that you might find handy. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. Should be a great one. I say we just dive right into the news. Starting off with iPads, and iPads continuing to lead the tablet market. Who would have thought after almost 10 years, it's been 10 years since the iPad was introduced, that the iPad would continue to not only lead the tablet market, but would potentially continue to be extending its lead. The latest IDC numbers for the fourth quarter shows iPad with a 36.5% share of the global tablet market. That was led by the success of the 10.2-inch iPad, which accounted for 65% of the total iPad shipments in the quarter. IDC estimated that in total, Apple shipped 15.9 million iPads in the last quarter, and that's because Apple does not share specific numbers. So take all of this with a grain of salt, because they are kind of speculating and guessing at these numbers. They show that Apple's share of the tablet market was up 22.7% from a year ago. And looking at the full year, Apple accounted for 34.6% of the market, shipping an estimated 49.9 million iPads. That would be up from 15.2% from the 2018 numbers. And all of this, while the overall tablet market has been shrinking, they noted that shipments overall were down 1.5% year over year. So Apple not doing too shabby in the tablet market. Another region where Apple potentially is picking up steam is in India. This is according to latest numbers from Counterpoint Research on iPhone sales in India that seem to show lower cost devices like the iPhone SE and the iPhone 11 are helping juice sales. They say iPhone shipments in India grew 41% in 2019. That is pretty impressive. They also say that Apple was the fastest growing premium smartphone brand in the region. They define ultra premium as devices selling above 45,000 rupees, or approximately $634 US. They also expect shipments to grow this year. They say that should be helped by reports of Apple manufacturing with partner Wistron In the region locally, they're assembling iPhone printed circuit boards for the first time. They've just started doing that, according to reports, which allows iPhones to be made in India on a completely knocked down basis, which means that all of the individual components are shipped to India and then all the assembly is done locally. And that results in some cost savings for Apple, reduced production costs, which then can be potentially passed on to the consumer in the form of lower prices or heavier promotional discounts, which is what has really been helping juice sales in India for Apple. So more iPhone sales in India is going to be good in 2020, especially if Apple can parlay and continue to work on that growth. There has been quite a bit of speculation and analysis lately on how the Apple TV Plus service is doing in terms of subscribers, subscriptions, and revenue. We know from Apple's last quarterly results call that Tim Cook said they were doing very well. My own words, not his, but basically he said they have been happy with how Apple TV Plus subscriptions are going. And we've talked to bit in the past about a few of the numbers. This week, we have Bernstein analyst Tony Sacconaghi thinking that very few Apple customers have actually taken advantage of their free year of Apple TV Plus, which to me is a little bit surprising. You get a free year with a new device. Why wouldn't you take advantage of that? He says that according to his research in an Investor's Business Daily post, that less than 10% of customers have taken advantage of that free service from Apple. If true, that would mean that the Apple TV Plus has possibly less than 10 million subscribers. And that's a bit surprising to me as well, because it seems to contradict two reports that we've already discussed here on the MacCast. One was a survey cited by the Wall Street Journal that estimated that Apple TV Plus had as many as 33.6 million subscribers, which would actually beat out Disney Plus. And also a recent report that six out of the top 10 streaming series in the month of December were TV shows or series that were available on the Apple TV Plus service. So those seem to indicate that a lot of people are watching Apple TV Plus. And if it's not coming from those free subscriptions, where are those coming from? Well, Apple does offer a 7-day free trial. And there are some numbers that we're going to talk about here in a minute that seem to support the fact that maybe a lot of people are taking advantage of that. The analyst is basing his guesses on Apple's last quarterly results call, and he believes that Apple has not been effectively promoting its new video service, frankly, that people just don't know about the free year. We've covered it here on the MacCast. Maybe it's an insider thing. I haven't seen too much promotion by Apple themselves, either via TV ads or really much online. So maybe this is on Apple, but I have a feeling his numbers are a little bit off. I do think that the Wall Street Journal numbers might have been a little bit optimistic or high. So it's likely somewhere in the middle. I'm guessing Apple could have between 20 to 30 million subscribers at this point. A cord-cutting service called Fixed also surveyed Apple TV subscribers to find out who would renew the free subscriptions after their trials were over, giving us a little insight there. They say that of folks who are on the one-year free subscription, 59% of them say that yes, they would resubscribe, but more interestingly, they also surveyed the folks that are on the 7-day free trial, and just 20% of those folks said that they would continue the service. As far as quality of the shows that Apple offers, they did ask about that. And overall, when you took all of the different shows that were available and averaged their scores, they scored an average of 7 out of 10, which is pretty high in terms of satisfaction. But then when asked why they wouldn't continue with the service, most people cited value for the money as being the reason that they would not resubscribe. So that says to me that people are more interested in quantity maybe than quality, and we do know that Apple has chosen to focus on quality rather than quantity. I do think that part of what this shows as well is that Apple needs the ability to sort of prove themselves to subscribers, and that a 7-day free trial is probably not long enough to do that. The huge difference between the number of people who would resubscribe from a 1-year free trial at 59% versus the number of people that would continue the service from a 7-day free trial, 28%, that discrepancy says to me that a lot of people who are just simply trying it out don't get to see enough of the shows. And as Apple grows out their catalog, I think that's going to be a little bit more important. So I would like to see Apple take the same tact they did with Apple Music and at least offer a 30-day free trial as a standard offer. I think the 1-year free is great, and hopefully they continue to offer that for purchasers of new devices or people that are coming to the Apple TV Plus service as new subscribers. And again, I'm waiting to see what happens as the 1-year free trials sort of close out, how many folks are going to re-up. I will tell you that for me, I will be renewing the subscription, and I wasn't positive at first, but I have enjoyed a number of the programs, and I know a lot of them are renewed for second seasons, so I can't wait to see the second season of The Morning Show. I was actually really surprised by that. I love Dickinson, For All Mankind. I'm a little bit waffling on, but I do want to see what happens in the next season. And I will tell you, the new series Mythic Quest, yeah, I just binge watched that like crazy. I wasn't planning on watching that one either, but it got some really great reviews in the tech media, which is surprising, and it could end up being a breakout hit for Apple. I have seen a couple of critical reviews, but most of them have been generally positive. And I will tell you, I plowed through it because I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it, and you might want to check that one out. So overall, I think Apple TV Plus is doing just fine. It's doing well enough for Apple, I think, that they are happy with its success. The analysts, they're kind of back and forth on where it might be, but I think at the end of the day, it comes down to how consumers feel about it. So what I'd love to know is, if you have been watching shows on Apple TV Plus, what are your thoughts on it? And do you think this tactic of going after quality versus necessarily quantity is going to ultimately work for them? I think they're going to end up doing both. I think it's going to be a lot like Apple Music, where they start out slow with a smaller catalog and build up slowly over time. And it's not going to be a runaway hit or an overnight success. We're talking 3 to 5 years for Apple to build up this service, but then I do believe it will be a dominant player with some amazing content. I'm still looking forward to Amazing Stories, which is coming down the pipeline, and also the Foundation series based on the Isaac Asimov novels. And so lots of great content coming, and that, at least for me, for $5 a month, that's going to keep me subscribed. But what do you think? Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. We have a quick story on Apple Watch, which outsold Swiss watches in 2019. Now, Apple doesn't share individual sales numbers on devices, but new data from Strategy Analytics estimates that Apple shipped 31 million Apple Watches worldwide in 2019. To add a little bit of perspective to this, they pointed out that the entire Swiss watch industry shipped 21 million units in 2019. The numbers also show that Apple Watch saw growth of 36% year over year, up from 22.5 million units sold in 2018. So I think that's the bigger number there. That's the thing we want to pay more attention to, is that more people are buying Apple Watch than ever before. That growth at 36% is incredible, and something that Apple will likely build upon in 2020. And I think a big factor in that is Apple keeping around an entry-level watch, the Apple Watch Series 3, that has an affordable price point to get people into the platform. And I think from there, they can build upon that. Customers fall in love with the Apple Watch, and I think then the next time they go to replace that, they might consider upgrading to a higher level model. I also think that there's somewhat of a halo effect that comes into play too, especially with Apple's services and apps and all the other things surrounding Apple Watch. So they end up making longer-term revenue, even if the upfront product is a lower price point. And I think more and more Apple is seeing the value in that. I think that's why we're seeing that with Apple Watch. I think that's why we see that with the 10.2-inch iPad, like we talked about earlier in this episode. And I also think that's why we're hearing about this upcoming $399 replacement for the iPhone XR, what's being rumored to be called the iPhone 9. And that's expected to happen here in the spring. So I think all of these things show that Apple has recognized the value in having a diversified line in terms of price point across all of their products. And Apple Watch is no exception. And I think based on the growth, it's proving to be quite effective for Apple. Apple this past week rolled out its latest betas for all of its operating systems, and there proved to be a bunch of new features. As often happens when new betas roll out, a number of folks who are very smart about these things go digging around to try and figure out and discover what secrets these betas might hold. And I wanted to share a couple of the interesting highlights with you. One of them is references in iOS to something called the Car Key API. The assumption here is that Apple might be planning to allow your iPhone to double as your car key using its built-in NFC chip. It's assumed that the functionality could be used to allow you to lock and unlock your car and possibly also start the vehicle. It appears to leverage Face ID for authentications, so you could walk up to your car, authenticate with Face ID, and then use the NFC chip to unlock the door, get in, and start the vehicle. The way it would work is it would pair and authenticate with the car's onboard system and work similarly to current radio-based keyless entry systems. Apple would be partnering with automakers to make this initiative work, suggesting that Car Key could become a factory installed option, sort of like CarPlay. There are also references that show the possibility of sharing keys to other devices, which brings some interesting scenarios as well. It does seem to indicate that you would have the ability to limit the shared key, so you could set it up that so that it might be only able to lock and unlock the car, but not necessarily start it. And I would assume, although it wasn't mentioned, that you would have the ability to put a time period on a shared key. So if you needed to give someone access to your vehicle, say for a day, you could set that up, but then it would automatically expire and they wouldn't have access with that shared key after that. And then I just need to point this out, because if you are a longtime listener of the MacCast, you know that we've talked often about Apple's car initiative, the Titan Project, and whether, you know, Apple is developing an autonomous vehicle, an electric car that they're going to sell to consumers or what have you. I have my theory that really what Apple is working on is an autonomous car as a service. So rather than purchasing a vehicle, you would subscribe to a fleet of cars available to Apple customers, and this could have some interesting applications there. Because in my vision of this thing, what would happen is you would have an app on your iOS device. You'd be able to request and summon a car whenever you need it. And at that point, it could issue you one of these keys that would be used to unlock and operate the vehicle. And so this could work perfectly for that. So I think there's lots of applications here. And it's interesting that there's this reference in the latest beta, because it feels like this is a feature that would be coming maybe in the next major version of iOS, because it likely will require some partnerships with automakers. So it could just be that they're kind of testing this out, playing around with it, and the references just happen to be in there for future versions of iOS. Another thing that looks like it's finally coming, and I say yes, finally, is iCloud shared folders. This was something that was supposed to be part of the iOS 13 release, but it got pulled back, and we haven't seen it since until now. It brings iCloud one step closer to services like Dropbox. Basically, it gives you the ability to share the contents with a folder of a folder in your iCloud drive with anyone you choose. You can allow only specific people to select and view a folder, or you can provide a link that anyone with access to that link would have access to that folder. And folders can have different permissions, and you can even set folders to be read-only. And so that is something I am looking forward to seeing. I think it's going to be really, really handy. Very often I've been wanting to share a folder with someone and do that through my iCloud storage, and it really hasn't been possible until now. Another feature that I hope they will extend this into is the ability to share an individual file, but for now it's looking like it's just going to be limited to entire folders. Of course, you could have a folder with just one file in it, but you know, for sharing a lot of individual files, that could not be necessarily really convenient. Another thing that is noted, and it looks like it's coming in this next release, is support for in-app purchases on Apple Watch. We know that Apple released the store on Apple Watch, so you can buy apps directly on your Apple Watch, but this would give the ability to buy in-app purchases like subscriptions or app upgrades directly from the watch itself. It also looks like there could be an updated version of the Apple TV 4K in the works. Codename references to a new model were discovered in the latest betas, and these seemed to show that it would be based on ARM 64E architecture, which would be an A12 or A13 series chip. So looking like an upgraded model with a newer version of an Apple chip in there. I think the current ones use an A10. No other indication of what might be in an updated Apple TV 4K, but that could be coming around the corner. And then finally, in macOS, and this may be the most interesting news of the bunch, there have been discovered references to AMD CPUs in the latest macOS Catalina betas. This is according to Engadget and based on a Reddit post. So I'm going to take this one with a little bit of grain of salt, but it seems like something that I think Apple would be looking into, because the AMD Ryzen processors are becoming very popular in the PC market. They are performing above and beyond a lot of the Intel chips, and the reference in here mentions something called Renoir, which is a code name meaning a Ryzen 4000 series chip. So it's very likely that Apple is not going to be switching to AMD chips, AMD Ryzen chips anytime soon, but I don't think it's I think it's very within the realm of possibility, I guess I should say, that they could be playing around with trying to get macOS running on AMD CPUs. This could put a little bit of pressure on Intel, and this could be simply for that. Also, we do know that we've had rumors for years that Apple is working on getting Macs running on their own processors, so that seems even more likely to me than Apple simply moving to AMD. I think Apple, another thing that we know that they do, and we know this from, you know, the switch from IBM to Intel, is that they hedge their bets. They like to have options just in case something goes wrong. So it could also simply mean that they're trying to get it up and running on AMD in case maybe something goes wrong with their own, you know, trying to transition to their own processor. Maybe something goes wrong with the relationship with Intel. They have a place that they can go to, and they're prepared and ready to move quickly if they need to do so. So I wouldn't read a ton into this, but it is pretty exciting because, again, those chips are exciting, and a lot of people are really, really liking them. And it would be great to see some competition with Apple or with Intel and AMD on the Apple platform, just like we see in the PC market. Apple's new indie repair program came under fire this week. That's because Motherboard got a hold of some of the contracts that small business owners would need to sign to become part of Apple's independent repair program. This is the program that would allow non-Apple authorized service providers to get access to Apple genuine parts, training, and resources to do repairs. In the report from Motherboard, they call the terms crazy and onerous. That's because businesses must sign an NDA even before they're allowed to get the contract that Motherboard got a copy of. Some of the terms that are being criticized are that Apple has the right to perform unannounced audits and inspections looking for prohibited repair parts and can impose fines if those parts are found. If Apple determines that more than 2% of a repair business's transactions involve prohibited parts, the business would be obligated to pay Apple $1,000 for every transaction that occurred during the audit period. They also say that Apple is allowed to continue audits for up to 5 years, even after the shop has left the repair program. Now, that one, I have to say, I agree with. That seems a little bit crazy that you leave the program, but Apple can still come in and audit your business. A few other things that are being criticized, shops must also display and disclose that they are not Apple authorized service providers and get customers written acknowledgement that they understand that. They also must provide consent and show that customers know that Apple does not warranty repairs made by independent repair providers. So if you get one of those repairs, have an issue with it, you're going to have to go back to that provider. You're not going to be able to get any warranty coverage from Apple. Shops are not allowed to use, quote, counterfeit products or service parts and, quote, products or services or service parts, excuse me, that infringe on Apple's intellectual property. Now, the problem here and where the complaint is that there is no clear list or explanation of what parts would be infringing or what parts would be considered counterfeit. And, you know, that is another thing that we've seen Apple typically do, especially with the App Store rules, right? They make rules that are relatively vague, and until they get challenged, you really don't know where the boundaries are. So that is a little bit confusing as well. Now, all of this said, I have to tell you, these kinds of terms are nothing new for Apple, as exemplified by the thing we just talked about there, the terms for apps and things like that. You can also just talk to any existing Apple authorized service provider, and they will go through the litany of hoops and challenges and restrictions and all of these things that Apple has imposed on them for years just to be Apple authorized service providers. So it's not easy working with Apple, folks. And this is just another example of that. I think the media is blowing it out of proportion a little bit, but certainly the challenges and frustrations are there. They just always have been there, and in my opinion, aren't really anything new. And that is also exemplified by the fact that many people and repair shops have signed up for the independent repair program, and they are just happy to have access to Apple genuine parts and resources to be able to better service their customers. And a number of them are speaking out and saying that they are fine with these terms. They're happy to sign them and they're happy to work with Apple. So I would say it's definitely going to be a mixed bag here, depending upon your perspective and what you're trying to do and how you're trying to run your business. And it is a step in the right direction. Is it going as far as Apple maybe needs to make these programs better? I don't think so. I'd like to see them working better and more openly and with less restrictions and barriers with both Apple authorized service providers and their independent repair program partners. that would give consumers a lot better choice and a lot better options. And I think that is all very positive. And if Apple can keep moving in that direction, great. This is a very tiny step, I think, toward that. And it could be made better and hopefully will get better over the coming years. You likely know that a lot of Apple's manufacturing is currently done in China, and I think it's probably no surprise to find out that Nikkei is reporting that the coronavirus in China is likely to impact supplies of Apple products, including AirPods. They point out that AirPods suppliers like Luxshare, Gore-Tek and Inventec have been shut down since the beginning of the Lunar New Year, and to make matters worse, overall component supplies in China are at all-time lows because of the outbreak. That means that even when production starts to ramp back up again, it's going to be slow going. This could push back supply shipments by as much as 2 weeks or more, depending upon the product. AirPods are already in high demand, as you know, and will likely see significant delays and shortages in the coming weeks or months. There's also already a prediction of significant impacts on iPhone. We've talked about that as well, and shipments of other products. And it really won't just impact Apple. It really is going to impact a lot of tech companies. Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that Apple is trying to prepare for this somewhat, that they have already moved some iPhone production to other factories and locations in India and Taiwan to help reduce the impact on iPhone shipments. These facilities, though, are a bit more limited in their capabilities versus the China sites, so while it will help a little bit, it's probably not going to mitigate the problem completely. And I just have to say, the reality of all of this, of course, is that none of these impacts on Apple products or tech products or any products whatsoever matter much in the face of the human toll of this thing. You know, this virus has now claimed more victims than SARS. It is a horrible epidemic. It is serious. And we can only hope that it is brought under control quickly and that more people are treated and less people die from this. It's terrible. And so, you know, while we talk about it here, because it is a tech-related story, I think a little bit of perspective is probably a good thing. And, you know, hopes and wishes go out to anybody, because we do have members of this community in affected regions. You know, our thoughts go out to any of you who are impacted by this, and we wish you the best. Finally, in the news, access to iCloud.com is now available on your mobile devices. Yep, if you've ever tried visiting iCloud.com on a mobile device, you know that support was very limited or non-existent at all. A lot of times you were told to access the services from your device or from your Mac. Now it looks like that Apple has recently changed that. You can now access a number of the services via browsers in iOS and Android on mobile. For phones, you can access the Photos, Notes, Reminders, and Find iPhone applications. On tablets, you have access to Mail, Contacts, Calendar, Photos, iCloud Drive, Notes, Reminders, Find Friends, and Find iPhone. So much more of a desktop experience for iCloud.com on tablets versus phones. Unfortunately, on the phone, you cannot seem to trick it by using the request desktop version of the site. Doing that gives you exactly the same access to the four apps: Photos, Notes, Reminders, and Find iPhone. But at the very least, especially for folks who are on non-Apple devices, this will give you some access to your iCloud.com services via the browser on your phone. So that's pretty cool, and I think a long time coming. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Zapier. Growing a business is hard, especially when you're wasting hours every day moving data from emails to spreadsheets to your CRM to whatever. Shouldn't that kind of stuff just happen without you having to lift a finger? Zapier can help. Zapier is the easiest way to automate your work. It connects all your business software and handles work for you so you can focus on the things that matter most. No more wasting time on tasks that you know could be automated, because that's exactly what Zapier was built to do. Just go to our special link, zapier.com/Maccast, and connect the apps you use the most and let Zapier take it from there. Zapier lets you instantly engage with leads, send them to a CRM or spreadsheet, then notify your team so they can act fast on every opportunity. And that's just scratching the surface. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so the possibilities are virtually endless. Best of all, it's easy to build the exact solution you need in minutes without writing code or asking a developer for help. Join the 4.5 million people who are saving an average of 40 hours a month by using Zapier. That's zapier.com/Maccast. ZAPIER.com/Maccast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the show. And I guess since we're talking about automation with a tool like Zapier, we should talk about a little bit about automation, because this week I received some feedback from a listener related to exactly that. We've covered automation with using tools like Automator and Shortcuts here on the show in the past. And it's one of those things that I feel like if you learn, you can really save a lot of time, or you can solve a particularly sticky problem where maybe one piece of software can't do it all by itself. You can use automation to kind of connect different applications to perform multiple tasks and to get things done. And getting into automation can seem daunting. It's a little overwhelming, especially if you're maybe not really technical or you're not a programmer, but we have a lot of great tools to make it easier. And once you get in and you start to learn it, even in a simple capacity, what'll happen is you'll find your skill set grows really quickly. And you'll also start to find lots of different ways that you can use automation. But like I said, getting into it can be a little bit tricky. And that's where what this listener sent in comes into play, because Eric sent a recommendation for a podcast that you might want to check out if you want help in getting into and expanding your automation skills. So here's what Eric had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Eric from Silicon Valley. I've been exploring automation recently, both on my Mac and my iOS devices. And I got into this through the Automators podcast hosted by Relay FM. I'd like to encourage your listeners who are interested in this topic to check them out. I think it's really quite a good starting place. The podcasts are hosted by David Sparks and Rosemary Orchard, who both are very much into automation. The episodes cover a wide range of topics. For iOS shortcuts, they cover a lot of extension tools such as Scriptable, allowing you to run JavaScript on your iOS devices, Pushcut, which allows you to trigger automations by receiving push notifications, and Toolbox Pro, which just adds a lot more actions to shortcuts. They do Mac automation as well, covering Keyboard Maestro, which seems to be the most popular and powerful tool. They also discuss web automation, which I did not know about, and include tools such as Zapier and Airtable. By linking all three of these things together, they've come up with some very complex and interesting automations for themselves. They do provide some screencasts on what's discussed in each episode, so you can follow along and see exactly how they do some of their automations. There's also a good discussion forum that has per-episode discussions and also per-product discussions. Two automations that I've built recently from learning about this stuff is when I take pictures with my camera that produces both RAW and JPEG images, when I plug my camera's SD card into my Mac, it triggers an automation to pull only the RAW format images and it ignores the JPEG images on the card. Another one is to tap an NFC tag in my car with my phone, which causes the most recent podcast I was listening to start playing. So I hope your listeners have found this useful. And Adam, As always, thank you very much for building the community you've made with the MacCast over these years. Bye-bye.
Hey, Eric, thank you for that recommendation. I had known our friend David Sparks was doing that podcast for a while, and I have to admit, I have not listened yet, but I definitely will be adding it to my list because I'd love to learn more about automation. I'll admit, you know, I've dabbled with it. I play around with it a little bit. I have a few automations that I use, but I've never really done a deep dive into it. And this sounds like a perfect way to jump in. Those of you who have heard David Sparks on this podcast before know he is an amazing dude. He writes some incredible tutorials and guides with his Mac Sparky field guides. As a matter of fact, he has a great one specifically on shortcuts. If you want to check that out over on his site at macsparky.com, I would encourage that as another way to get into automation, especially on iOS. But I think this is a great tip, and everybody definitely should check that out. So thank you, Eric, for sending that in. Now I need to follow up on something from a previous podcast and correct a little gap in my knowledge. And yes, there is a bad pun in there because I just love bad puns. On the last podcast, I was talking about Apple's services revenue, specifically related to Apple TV Plus. This was after their earnings call. And I mentioned that while those subscription numbers or those numbers were good, I mentioned that they might not be as good as they could be because Apple was giving away a lot of free Apple TV Plus subscriptions, and we really don't know what's going to happen when those convert or start to convert over to paid subscribers later in the year. And as noted earlier in this podcast, even that now is up for debate because a lot of folks are maybe not on the free subscription. But the point was, is that, hey, Apple's given away a lot of free subscriptions. I was basically saying those aren't being accounted for in that services revenue. And it actually turns out, because of generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, there's the pun, Apple may already be, or is, and as a matter of fact, already counting those free subscriptions as revenue. And I know this now because listener John wrote in to educate me about GAAP and a little bit of how that works. And I will share that information with you. Apple actually does have to, under general accepted accounting principles, subtract the cost of those subscription fees from the revenue that they earn on the devices themselves. So since that revenue is tied to devices, or that freebie is tied to a device, so I buy an iPhone or I buy an Apple Watch or I buy an iPad and I get a free year of Apple TV Plus service, they have to take the cost of that service, I guess, out of that revenue. So they take from that revenue and then they move that over to the services revenue. So that money is actually being shifted. And that could be a good or bad thing, depending upon how you look at it. Because I guess right now, with this last quarter numbers, if you believe that a lot of people have signed up for those free subscriptions, that means that a lot of that generated revenue in services might not hold up once those free subscriptions start to expire and people are forced with that decision, do I renew or do I not renew? Because personally, I feel if Apple can retain 10 to 25% of the people that are under the free subscription, I think they would be doing pretty well. I'd like them to maintain more, but I have a feeling a lot of people are going to drop off the service once they don't get it for free anymore. And Apple will have a challenge getting those subscriber numbers up. As we've said, though, I also feel like Apple's not super concerned about those numbers. But the point is, from a pure revenue perspective, from a quarterly results call perspective, it could mean they could see a significant revenue drop when they're not accounting for, you know, shifting that free subscription over from the iPhone column to the Apple TV, you know, subscription services column. Of course, it also means that the revenue on the iPhone or iPad side would go up proportionally, right? Because that money is not going to be taken out of that column. So there's, you know, accounting fun going on here, I guess we should say. And if the free subscriber numbers are as low as some allege, then hey, maybe it won't be that bad after all either. So who really knows? But the point is that I had no idea that that was sort of how it worked. And thank you, John, for sending in that information and educating us a little bit. I want to continue our discussion about what a future iMac might look like, because a couple weeks ago we had a report that there might be a radical new design or redesign coming for the iMac, with kind of this curved all glass front and little wedge base and an embedded display right inside the glass, something that looks like kind of awesome and beautiful. And I asked the question, hey, you know, if Apple was rebuilding the iMac or redesigning the iMac, what kinds of features, what things would you like to see in it? And we've been slowly getting feedback from our community. I shared some of that with you on the last episode. This time around, I got a couple emails. The first one from Dan, who says he'd like to see the iMac mount potentially on that $1,000 Pro XDR display arm that Apple built for the Pro XDR display. I find that very interesting. I'm not sure, Dan, that a $1,500 iMac on a $1,000 arm, stand is a wise financial choice for a lot of people, but I definitely get what you're going for there. It would be really sexy to see an iMac mounted on that stand. And I know, you know, $1,500, that's a pretty cheap iMac. They're probably more like in the $2,000, $2,500 range, even higher depending upon which configuration you get. But you get my point. That's a pricey stand for your iMac, but it would be great as an option for people who might want to get that. Although in the same email, Dan mentions that he'd like to see Apple add more ergonomics as well, which I agree with. Level adjust, tilt, angle adjustment, just more ways to be able to adjust the iMac. And the XDR stand actually has quite a few limits. It can't, for example, tilt left and right, and it has very little play, I think, in terms of doing level adjustment, and there's actually been some complaints about that. So that might not be the best way to go. Maybe it's still going to need its own built-in stand, but definitely something that has a lot more movement, a lot more adjustment, I completely agree with. Dan also mentions no more spinning hard drives, all SSD. I'm 100% on board with that. I'm with you there, Dan. And he says he'd like to see the iMac keep its broad range port selection. I would assume with some updates, although he didn't specifically mention that, but you know, updates to things like Thunderbolt 3, USB-C, all of that fun stuff. I think they might have USB-C in there, but you get my point. More Thunderbolt 3 support, all of those sorts of things. And I think you're spot on there, Dan. Daniel also wrote in with some of his thoughts and ideas. One that I thought was great is get rid of the 21-inch model. I totally agree with that. I think 24-inch should be the baseline. Have that, the 27-inch. And Daniel mentions, hey, why not a XL option, a max option, like a 32-inch iMac? I think, you know, three sizes, let's go for it. I have no problem with that. It does expand the line a little bit, and I like it when Apple keeps it simple, but why not 24, 27, and 32? I think that's a good range of sizes. And Daniel was also on the all SSD bandwagon. Again, I'll just say yes on that one. Let's just do solid state, no more spinning drives. He said, again, same as Dan, make it possible for the user to adjust the height, the swivel, the tilt of the display. He thought it would be great if they could add in Face ID support. I think that would be awesome as well. Why not throw the true depth camera system in there? And while you're at it, put it on the notebooks as well. Let's take that thing all the way across the board, get rid of having to manually type in passwords or use fingerprint touch ID. And then another thing that I really like that Daniel mentioned was expandability. He's, you know, make it easier to add and install a second hard drive. I'll go one further. Make it easier to swap out the primary drive. You know, why not give us easier access this. They could build a port or a door. Or they could design it in a way where it would be simple to upgrade. And I say, let's do that for RAM across the board too. I don't know why we have it limited to just specific models. We should be able to upgrade RAM and drives very easily. And there's no reason a new iMac design couldn't account for both of those things. And then Daniel had a few other requests outside of the iMac that I thought were pretty good. He says, how about a more affordable 24-inch Apple display option? So, you know, let's do a consumer version of the Pro XDR display. He didn't get into specifics, but, you know, I could see it being something that would, you know, nicely match the iMac design aesthetic and at least be a 4K display, maybe even a 5K display. And that would be awesome. And as Daniel mentions, could be a great display option for other Mac owners, including buyers of Mac minis as well. So I think it is time for Apple to jump back into the display market, and it would be wonderful to see them do a range of displays at a variety of price points. Of course, they're going to have that Apple premium on them, but still, you know, let's bring back a, you know, $1,000, $2,000 Apple display that's a little bit more affordable for folks who don't want to drop $6,000 on an XDR. So I think these were all great suggestions and options. Please keep them coming. I love getting your feedback on this or any other topics. Shoot your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Now, here's a cool little Siri tip I ran across this week and something I don't think I would have ever thought to try. And I wasn't really surprised that it was in there, but it wouldn't be something that I think I would ever figured out myself. So I wanted to share this with you as well. Did you know that you could ask Siri what your passwords are? I know it sounds like a little bit of a security issue, but it really isn't when you hear how it works. If you use iCloud Keychain to save and store your web passwords, you can just simply ask Siri the next time you forget what your password is. You can simply say, you know, hola lady, what is my Facebook password? Or hola lady, what are my passwords? And what will happen is Siri will open up the settings. After you authenticate with Face ID or Touch ID, you will be shown your password. And this works both on the Mac and with iOS. And, you know, it's something that you could always do manually, but hey, why not automate it a little bit? This is a much quicker way to get into that stuff. If you still prefer to go the manual route, I'll cover that for you as well. On iOS, what you're going to do is you're going to open up settings. You're going to go into passwords and accounts. You're going to tap on website and app passwords. Then you will have to authenticate, again, using Face ID, Touch ID, or entering your passcode, however you prefer. And then once you're authenticated, you can search or browse for the account password you're looking for, and then tap on it to get the password. On the Mac, you're going to use Safari, so launch Safari. Under the Safari menu, go to Preferences. In the Preferences panel, click on the Passwords tab. Then you will have to authenticate by using Touch ID or entering in your Mac's password. And then once you've done that, you can search for or select the account you're looking for. Click on the item in the results list, and it will then again display your password for you. Right? So you can see several clicks and steps to get there if you do it manually. If you simply just ask Siri, she'll take you right there. So I thought that was a really cool tip. And if you have additional Siri-related tips, I would love to get these from you, especially if there's something you think might be a little less known, a little more obscure that you can do with Siri that maybe people don't normally think of. If you have any of those, send those emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. All right, then the last thing that I have for you in the show for this week is a thing of the moment, and this one is once again a listener thing of the moment. It came in via email, and it is for typing on the Apple Watch. Typing on the Apple Watch can definitely be tricky. Personally, I am a big fan of the gesture keyboard, what Apple calls the scribble keyboard or the scribble feature. I think that works quite well, where you just kind of draw out the characters. I wish it had a little bit more functionality, especially if we're doing punctuation and spaces. It can kind of get punctuation okay, but it'd be nice if it kind of had, and this is going to show my age getting to some old school stuff, but there was a thing on the Newton where you could use a little gesture to either swipe in a certain way or draw a line in a certain way to delete a character. And there was a little gesture or a pattern you could draw for inserting a space. And it'd be nice to be able to do that right in the Scribble keyboard or the Scribble interface, but you can't, there is nothing for that. But hey, that's where this thing of the moment comes into play this week, because it is an app called FlickType. And you might think it would be impossible to offer a QWERTY-style keyboard on such a small display, but according to listener Dan, he says you would be wrong, because he says FlickType is, quote, amazing. It's a tiny keyboard that you can actually type with. He says it beats the Scribble keyboard hands down. And he does say that on his Apple Watch Series 2, it takes a little bit of time to launch. But beyond that, he absolutely loves using it. And it's like $1.99 on the App Store. So it's pretty affordable. And if it helps you type a little bit better on your Apple Watch, a little bit easier, and you find that is a thing that you need, it's probably worth checking out. So you can check it out. I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And Dan, thanks for sending that one in, because again, that was another one that I had not run across, and I'm going to be checking it out myself. So thank you for that. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great applications and software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on social media. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Instagram at MacCast on Instagram. And that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.